I'd like to read the title poem of my collection. It is titled The Taste of the Earth, same as the book. Two fawns cross the creek. One of them pauses, linked to his mirror reflection by the tip of his tongue. Parallel worlds merge onto the fault line of a folded image. A musical phrase sticks to your skin. The wind espouses ripples. Liquid dunes lick the shoreline, give moisture to wild brush, blown over seeds and thoughts. Iridescent hummingbirds hover over purple iris blooms. The shore is faithful to the stream's first touch. Like first love, it nourishes tendrils rising into a green flame. Never forgotten, like the taste of the earth. A desert thirsts for an oasis. A fawn melts into the music of a fable, a gazelle. New memories map rhizomes, twisting, anchoring us farther with each shoot, spreading from our birthplace to everywhere we've lived, to where we live now. And does it make a difference if the root remembers?
Does it, Hetty?
Yes, indeed, it does. It does, and I think that in every place we've lived, we make roots. And when we part with these places, these roots are still alive within us. And I was born and raised in Cairo, in Heliopolis, Cairo, Egypt, and then moved to Lebanon, left Lebanon at the onset of the civil war, and then lived in Greece and Belgium, where my husband was transferred, and then came to the States in 81. So this is a sort of succession of planting trees in the yard and making friendships and absorbing cultures, and all of that is something that we can't erase.
And probably wouldn't want to. I mean, all of those places that you've been are a part of who you are today, I'm sure. This is your third collection of poetry, The Taste of the Earth. And you said earlier it's a continuation of some of your earlier work, that it's a memoir in poems. I love that. Talk about how it's a continuation and how it is a kind of returning home to your roots.
In my first collection, Tea in Heliopolis, I was reminiscing about my youth and upbringing in Egypt. I was trying to put together all those fragmented memories, and I also had recently moved from Lebanon, and the civil war lasted 15 years, so those poems were written over 20 years. So that was the content of Tea in Heliopolis. It was mostly a response or trying to put together my identity or explaining myself to myself and to others. But this third collection follows a collection of ekphrastic poetry, because I love writing about art. I'm a visual artist, and I've painted the cover of my three poetry collections. But with The Taste of the Earth, it is a reflection from the present about all of these events. So it's like so many decades after the fact, and I reflect upon my linguistic roots as well as my childhood roots. And so there is a sort of cultural and mythological context to some of the poems. But at the same time, I also reflect upon going back to Lebanon after 25 years and seeing the changes. So all of these poems are in many ways a memoir, but trying to retrieve memories. Sometimes memories would come in a voluntary, sometimes an involuntary way. And sometimes when we try to recreate these memories, there is a certain certain parts of these memories, like a face that has faded in our recollections. So to which extent are these different fragments, different poems, reflecting our lives? This is for the reader to put together all the silences and gaps of poetry.
You've done some experimental work in this collection, too, including a perspective of inanimate objects. I think that's a really unique perspective. Talk about that.
I've enjoyed writing lots of persona poems when I wrote Under Brushstrokes, which were poems inspired by art. But in this specific collection, especially in the fifth part, that consists of reflections about the aftermath of the violence in the Middle East and, of course, in Aleppo and Damascus, there was no other way to express my feelings as I was watching, like many others, what was going on, but using the voice of an abandoned fountain, an abandoned stone house, an abandoned orchard, or an olive tree that had been uprooted. And those voices seemed to me to express the losses and the violence, or at the same time expressed also the beauty that once existed in these places. The other two mainly experimental sections are titled Meditations. Meditations over the Phoenician letters is the one that takes me back to my Lebanese linguistic roots, because the Phoenicians gave us our alphabet. And I knew it had also given the Hebrew alphabet and the Arabic alphabet. But when I started researching the connections, I saw that there was striking resemblances with the spoken Arabic right now. And so I wrote an abecedarian based on these letters that I printed on the page. And so it's a quasi-ekphrastic series of poems in which I also use Arabic script, and in a way to see how languages really maintain, although like Phoenician letters that are no longer used, they are still alive in other spoken languages like Hebrew, like Arabic, and it has given us our Western alphabet. So I was trying to make connections between all of these languages and what really we are. We really are not disconnected. We are a whole. And the other experimental section is titled Meditations Over the Eye of Horus. And that in that one I used, I went back to the symbolism of the Eye of Horus, because the Egyptians believed that the Eye of Horus symbolized the six senses, and it was a very powerful amulet. So I divided the poem in six sections. Each one was composed by a series of haibuns, a prose poem followed by a haiku, and then each of the senses series group ended with a litany. A repetition of 10 verses that were always around, anaphorically repeating the same sense. So it is through these six senses that I made this kind of connection with ancient Egyptian myths, my personal upbringing, my personal memories, and my cultural context, if you wish. So all that really makes my being, in other words, my readings, my interests, my memories, are juxtaposed in a sort of collage in that section.
When you wrote this collection, was this based on returning home in your mind's eye or an actual trip home?
I did take one actual trip home 25 years after the war had started. So it had Beirut was reconstructed And so this is what triggered one section of the book. The third section was about going back physically. But this collection was in the make for 12 years. And so I've been in my mind always going back and keeping, you know, all those memories alive, and also watching what was going on and lamenting the fact that there were still lots of sequels to the turmoil.
I imagine that's a journey of mixed emotions, a longing perhaps, painful in some ways, nostalgic, perhaps a joy of seeing some of your childhood places again.
It was everything that you have described. We still have lots of relatives, and the country, of course, is unique. There are lots of beauties all over the world, but because Lebanon is such a small country, it offers, you know, the ocean and the mountains and all the archaeological structures, and we have the remains of more than 17 civilizations, the Ottomans, the Romans, the Greeks. The fact is that it's a beautiful country. When I went back, there was a lot of reconstruction, but so the downtown of Beirut was completely destroyed. But within that reconstruction, there was sort of a sort of erasure, because there were some places that had ceased to exist that were replaced by more modern constructions. Also, in many instances, in many areas of Beirut, there would be some reconstruction, some facades that were completely redone, but next to them there was a house with the triple arch that still had bullet holes or scars. And so this is something these were like visual signs in some ways of certain things that don't change. So I was trying to find my bearings. I was trying to remember where did that street go? Where did that cafe across the street from the university go? It's no longer here. Yeah. And so I think the best way to express all of these things is through poetry, because poetry allows you to leave silences, gaps, and points of interrogation. Whereas in a narrative, it becomes like you're almost trying to reconstruct and recreate something totally new. Whereas with poetry, you have all of these sometimes somewhat contradictory emotions that can be juxtaposed.
Finally, the cover. Not only do you write and you're a poet, but you're also a painter. So talk about the cover.
Well, I struggled in order to paint this cover, because it's I use the technique that I've been learning, the Chinese ink on rice paper. But this one was particularly difficult because of the symmetry of the design. And of course, when I paint, I try to use some kind of visuals as inspiration, and then I depart from the original. But I know that I spent several months doing lots of versions till I had the one that that pleased me. And it is focusing on the Eye of Horus. On the cover, there are in the center the Eye of Horus and the four sons of Horus that are usually placed in canopic jars when a pharaoh is mummified. There are always the four sons of Horus that are the symbols of what remains of the deceased is conserved in these canopic jars. So it's a way of conserving the memory for an afterlife or a better future, who knows.
Well, we have yet another voice in the room here, another word artist. We also have Dasha Nisula here. And before we ask you questions, Dasha, if you could read from, well, you've got two books here, two new books. So what have you chosen?
Well, I have chosen a poem by Slavko Mihalic because it comes from the collection Music is Everything. And Slavko Mihalic is a Croatian poet, and the arts essentially dominated his life. He initially was going to become a musician, then an artist, and finally the word won out. So I'm going to read a poem from that collection. It's entitled Mozart's Magic Coach. The earth, too, is a magic coach, my dear. Look at the flocks of elves that pull it down dark, virgin forests of the universe. And a witch or two, it's known, would like to diverge it into a coy ditch in a passionate embrace. But there is a coach within the coach. The traveler is a boy who keeps changing his face from town to town, golden or lousy one, from tavern to tavern in the forest among ancient trees that sing slowly, swaying their heads on the slopes of fields where wizard plowmen pull golden grains from sensual depths of the earth, from hills to violins and tempestuous timpani. My dear Mozart, sometimes he's a coachman. At times, even horses pull the coach skyward, so frightened winds disperse to all sides of the Danube, Vltava, and the Rhine. Sometimes a lascivious traveler who drinks the sweetest wine from women's lips, from bell-shaped breasts, because music is everything, since music can do everything. When music ceases, all the magic is only a modest craft. As shoeing a horse echoes flutes when the blacksmith is Mozart, and a jug of wine sings if Mozart's lips touch the oboe. Rain begins to glisten, footsteps make sense, hills turn azure, streets race, and curtains are the bare backs of women when on its own plays Mozart's piano.
What is different with your work is that it's translations. Now, personally, I am bilingual, and I've always found that translating is even harder than writing an original, because you have to figure out what that poet was thinking and feeling and find an accurate phrase or word. And to me, that's incredibly challenging.
You're absolutely right. And I will use the words that a Russian poet, Vyacheslav Kuprianov, who came once to WMU, and we did a bilingual reading, and he told me himself, he's a poet and translator. He said translating is much more difficult. And then I want to add also Slavko Mihalic's comment. He has a poem in which he says that a poem looks for its poet. And I'm saying a poem looks for its translator. And this helps me understand why I have never translated a whole book from cover to cover by a single poet. I always have to find out which poems are speaking to me, which are looking for me, that is to say. And then I go for those. So if there is any good, if this is a good translation in any way, then perhaps this poem was looking for me.
Ah, I like that. But no two languages mirror each other exactly. I mean, every culture has its own way of looking at the world. That's where I would get frustrated. How do you deal with that when you have a concept or a word or a phrase that simply doesn't exist in English?
Well, translating a poem takes many drafts.
Oh, I'm sure.
And each time you look at it, look at the draft, you think of something else. And if you are very deep, you have to really know the language and you have to feel that poem. And the words will come, they will come. If you are in it, you have to be in it for a long time, I guess.
When you take on a translation, do you get to know the poet, the person, whether living or not? Do you study the poet as well to kind of get a sense of how they saw the world, or do you just take on the poem?
To be honest with you, I prefer not to know anything about the poet. It's best not to know,
okay,
because some of this knowledge may influence you in some way. I like to look at the poem. For example, the book by Vesna Parun. This woman had an extremely difficult life, and I was able to identify with it in some way, but not knowing too many details about her. I learned about her more once she passed on. But I think I want to deal just with the work, just with the work.
Okay, okay. And why did you choose these two poets? You just mentioned Vesna Perun.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about her, now that you surely have learned about her.
Yes.
Well, and why you chose her work.
All right. I was trained in Slavistics. That was my interest. In fact, I grew up in Chicago. I was looking for my roots, and they are Slavic roots. And so I thought I should know some of these Slavic languages. I should know more about my background. And when I was in school in California at USC, they assigned me a class in Croatian. And at that time, there was hardly anything available to use for students or for classwork. And I looked around and found Vesna Parun's book of poetry. And I started looking what I could bring to class. And I did bring a couple of things. And then the students asked me to translate and tell them more about what that was. And I did. And then I really got interested in her work. And that's where that comes from. And Slavko Mihalić's work, I met him at a conference in Zagreb in Croatia. This was a conference on less commonly taught languages in English translation. It was an interesting conference. I met him there. He gave me his book. I told him I translate. He gave me his book. And I took the book and I found many interesting poems, but I was not able to do very much as the time went on. And I only this year was able to pull together some 100 poems in this book, Music is Everything. So,
well, that's quite a bit. How long does it take you to translate so many poems?
It takes a while.
Years, I would think, right?
Yes, I would say it takes years if you're going to do, especially it depends what you are doing. If your assignment is just to translate, and you can do much more during a week. But sometimes you need a break from that also. But if you are working full-time and you are adding on translations, then it takes years.
Yeah, I would think so. Well, the two of you are coming together to read at Kazoo Books on Tuesday, January 21st at 6:30 p.m., what can the audience expect? How are you? Are you blending your work somehow together, or taking turns, or what can we expect from this evening?
I think we talked about that, Dasha and I, and we'll just take turns and try to be as faithful to what we've done as we did today with this interview. And hope there will be lots of questions and answers afterwards, which is my favorite part.
Yeah. What kind of questions would you love to take on?
I would like to talk about the forum, for example. If I had a PowerPoint, I would project some of the visual forms that I've used. But when I do a reading, I hold on sometimes the book, open pages to show a little bit. So that's the kind of questions that are always challenging, but at the same time interesting. And then also the questions that people ask about the Middle East, about my roots to the States. I've been here 40 years, but at the same time, although my allegiance is to the United States, my allegiance is to my other roots. It's like what makes up a person. You are made out of where you've lived and what you have also read.
Yeah.
So I just hope that out of the poems that I will read, there will be some questions, because there isn't a lot that people know, unfortunately, about the Middle East in the States, whereas if you have a European audience, like French and British, they're so much closer because they have had so many interactions over the years, and they're still much more attuned, especially the French, because the French presence was there, although people don't know it, in Egypt since Napoleon's times, and then Lebanon, of course, was a protectorate of France. And then, of course, since the Crusades, there was a lot of interaction between France and Lebanon. So if in an indirect way one can kind of emphasize or explain all these connections, I think this is basically what I would like.
Well, both of you will be bringing something of different cultures to the audience, literature that isn't necessarily, well, it is American and it isn't. I mean, you bring your own roots to this. What is the value of that? Why is it important for us to read poetry that is not necessarily written in our own neighborhood?
Well, I'll tell you. I look at the work of Slavko Mihalic, and he's a magician, and he creates a world in words. And having a strong musical background, he will do a fugue, a cantata, a madrigal, or anything in words. It's incredible. And I think that he speaks about the human condition. Messages to individuals who are living at the crossroads, and on one side there is life and on the other side there's death, and here is a human being trying to deal with this every day. So his work speaks to everybody. It's not Croatian or Russian or British or American. It's for every human being everywhere. And I think the same thing is about Vesna Parun, a woman who is the first Croatian woman who lived for and by writing, and brings out her experience as a young woman, as a mature woman, and as a woman who's experienced loss. And she deals with all this in writing it out, and we can all share that. If we are living, we experience everything that these two poets have experienced.
So there's something from different cultures, and at the same time, something that we experience no matter where we live in the world.
Correct.
Well, thank you both so much for coming in, and we'll see you at Kazoo Books.
Thank you very much, Zenaida.
Us.